Thank you for listening to the Shanghai Community Fellowship Podcast. To find out more about the SCF community, listen to sermons, and upcoming events, visit us at shanghaifellowship.org.
Thank you, Pastor Dale. And thank you for the opportunity to share. I will reiterate, I do love this church. I remember first coming here, I started attending in January of 2002, many, many years ago. Somebody once asked me, how do you become an elder? And my response, I think it was attrition. Everyone kept leaving and I stayed. So I've been around, and I remember 2002 at that time, the first time I came here, I was just struck by how vibrant, diverse, and Christ-centered this church is, and was just blown away. And 17 and a half years later, many of the people who were there then are no longer here, and it's a lot of new faces, but there's something about the DNA of this church that is the same, and still very Christ-centered, very diverse, and very vibrant. So it's a blessing to be a part of this community, and I'm very grateful. So let me segue from talking about the church here in Shanghai to talking about the church in Smyrna. And our PowerPoint's working again. I'm continuing a series that was started last week by Pastor Dale that focuses on the seven churches in the book of Revelation, chapters 2 and 3. So these are seven historical churches that Jesus gives messages to through John, who is the author of Revelations. And one thing that Pastor Dale pointed out last week when he started this series is that while these are very specific messages to very specific historical communities, the teachings and the lessons are for all people in all places in all times, for all of us to learn from, including all of those who call themselves Christ followers in Shanghai in 2019. So today I'm going to talk about the second church in that series. It's the church in Smyrna. And let me start by giving a little background on the city of Smyrna. I have a map up here. It's located in the present-day city of Izmir in Turkey. And during the early church times, Smyrna was strategically located, if you can kind of find it there on the map. It was strategically located on this trade route. So Smyrna was a city that was very important. It was very prosperous. And it was highly developed. It was known for its beauty. The next slide has an image of modern-day Izmir and how beautiful that is on the ocean there in the Mediterranean. And then also it was known for the beauty of its public buildings. So it was very highly developed, and it was famous in that area. It was, however, not a city that was accommodating to the early Christian believers. Smyrna was known for its devotion to the emperor in Rome, and perhaps by extension, paganism. And as such, the Christians in the early church there were persecuted, they were imprisoned. After this message was recorded in Revelations later, the leader of the church in Smyrna, a man by the name of Polycarp, was martyred. So it's in that context that Jesus gives a message to this church, and I'll read from Revelations chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. It says, these are the words of Jesus, "To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these are the words of him who is first and last, who died and came to life again. I know your affliction and poverty, yet you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison to test you, and you will suffer persecutions for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be harmed by the second death." What we see here in this passage is Jesus' message for a church that is afflicted and afraid. This is a community of believers there that is afflicted and afraid. And interestingly, of the seven churches, Smyrna is the only one that is not outright rebuked by Jesus. Rather, in their afflictions and in their fear, he gives a message of encouragement and hope. And so with my time today, I want to focus on two verses in this passage. One that gives encouragement to those who are afflicted, and the second that gives hope to those who are afraid. So firstly, encouragement for the afflicted. As I mentioned, the community in Smyrna, they were facing persecution at the time. There were people that were going to prison. They were impoverished. They were experiencing hardship. They likely had social rejection, perhaps familial rejection. They had afflictions. They were, in a word, suffering. And suffering is a common theme throughout the Bible, right? From the early Old Testament days, the Hebrews and Israelites, through the disciples and the followers of Jesus in the New Testament, to Jesus himself and on to the early church, suffering is a common theme throughout the Bible. And as you look through it and as you understand how the Bible talks about suffering, there's two common important truths that emerge. The first is that Christians suffer, right? Christians suffer. If you thought becoming a Christian was somehow going to relieve you of any hardship in life, that's not the Christianity of the Bible. In the Bible, it's not a question of if you're going to suffer, but when you're going to suffer and how you respond to that suffering. And sometimes we suffer because we are Christians. And it's a direct result of our identities as Christ followers. So that's the first truth. Christians suffer. However, the second truth is that God provides purpose in our sufferings and can even bless us in our afflictions. He uses adversity to mature us. He uses our struggles to prepare us for bigger and better things. He uses our difficulties to make us more empathetic to others. And he uses our afflictions ultimately to draw us closer to him. So it's with that context that Jesus gives this message to the church in Smyrna. I know your afflictions and poverty, yet you are rich. I know your afflictions and poverty, yet you are rich. You know, one of the neat things as you read Jesus' teachings during his ministry on earth, as he taught about, you know, the ways of God, is he would often turn kind of worldly wisdom on its head, right? He often would contrast the values of the world with the values of the kingdom of heaven. He said of himself in John 18, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." And when he prayed for his disciples, he prayed that they would be in the world, but not of the world. And then Paul, in the same vein, Paul writes in his letter to the church in Corinth, he says that the wisdom of the world is foolishness in God's sight. And then another part, he says the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. So Jesus took the conventional wisdom of the world and he turned it on its head. He had a kind of a common turn of phrase where he would say, "You've heard it said this, but I tell you that," right? He would say like, you've heard it said an eye for an eye, but I tell you to turn the other cheek. Or you heard it said, do not murder, but I tell you that even those who are angry are subject to punishment. Jesus taught us what God actually values. Right? When he was here and during his ministry, Jesus did not spend time with the people that the world valued, the rich and the powerful. He spent time with the lowly and the despised and the outcast. When he told people who was blessed, he didn't say that the blessed were the affluent and the political leaders of the day, not even the most kind of pious religious leaders at the time. In fact, he said that the religious leaders of the time, the Pharisees, were hypocrites and even called them a brood of vipers. Rather, Jesus said, the ones who are blessed are who? The poor in spirit, the meek, the peacemakers, those that hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, those that are persecuted for righteousness. Jesus turned worldly wisdom on its head so that we can better understand God's values and God's priorities and the way that God sees things. And he tells Smyrna, I know your afflictions and poverty, yet you are rich. I know your afflictions and poverty, and yet you are rich. One of the most, I guess, formative times in my life spiritually was when I was a college student. Before I came to China, I went to college in the U.S., and I grew a lot spiritually, but it was actually a really difficult time for me in many ways. Firstly, financially, I was broke. I had no money, and I remember, like, I had no savings, I had no financial support from my family, and I was just living kind of one measly paycheck to another. I had a couple jobs, and always, you know, I had a bank account that was, I would feel like, always in, like, single digits. I remember one time actually going to a supermarket, and I had, I had what's called a debit card, which I know not everywhere uses a debit card. And it's where, when you swipe it, instead of a credit card where you kind of borrow money, it pulls money straight from your account. So if you have $100, you can pull $100. If you have $2, then you know you can only spend $2. And I knew I had a few dollars in my account. I couldn't remember exactly how much. And I went to the supermarket to buy some provisions. So I went to buy a carton of milk. I remember a carton of milk and a bag of potato chips. So this is, I guess, a college man's diet to some extent. And I went to the cash register and I swiped my card and insufficient funds. I didn't have enough money for my milk and potato chips. And I remember, but I know I had some money. So I remember I was like, I could probably buy one of these things. So I kind of had looked and had to choose, and I chose the potato chips. Definitely chose the potato chips. Lived on those for a couple of days until. So I was broke, but I was also broken. And that was a season in my life where also, especially with my family situation, there were a lot of challenges that I was dealing with. My parents, who had been married for 30 years, were getting separated. My father in particular at that time, he was struggling with alcoholism. I remember while I was a student in college going to an intervention for him, later visiting him in rehab as kind of a, maybe related to that, my dad went bankrupt and we lost the house that I'd grown up in. So, you know, when I'd go home in the summer or for Christmas, we were in a different place, and it was challenging. And I remember every time I'd go back and be with my family, there was this kind of cloud of depression that hung over them that I too was in some ways affected by. But in other ways, I remember that time being also an amazing time. Right, I was broken and I was broke, but in God, I felt truly rich. I felt actually blessed because I didn't find my worth and my meaning in my bank account, certainly, or even in my family situation. But during that season, I was drawn closer to God and I received from him comfort and the things that are of him, peace and joy. And I had a sweet intimacy with God during that season that I would not have known had I not gone through those afflictions. I know your afflictions and poverty, and yet you are rich. And I do believe there are many of you here today that you need that same encouragement. And you need to know that you are rich. And it's not until those things are fixed in your life that you can receive the richness that God has to offer you. But you are rich. Your bank accounts may be low, yet you are rich. You may have a difficult work situation and a terrible boss, yet you are rich. You may have health problems and constant physical pains that you're struggling with, yet you are rich. You may have a struggling marriage or a lot of uncertainty about your future, yet in Christ, you are rich. God is telling us today that just like he was telling Smyrna, I know your afflictions, I know your struggles, I know your poverty, yet you are rich. It's the first message, the first encouragement that Jesus gave the church in Smyrna. The second message is one of hope for those who are afraid. Hope for those who are afraid. The topic of fear is something that God's really been kind of convicting me of lately to think about and ask myself, to what extent am I seeing my life or seeing the world through a lens of fear, right? Am I living my life based on fear? Or am I making decisions that are fear-based decisions, or are they faith-based? And I think it's not just me. I think fear in the world today is pervasive, it is oppressive. We see a lot of anxiety, which is kind of rooted in fear, and there's so much that we're fearful of, right? We're afraid of political trends. We're afraid of getting sick. We fear for our kids. We fear getting old. Some of us, our careers, we're afraid of, well, gosh, what if I don't get that promotion that I need? Or what if I don't have enough savings to retire? Or some of us have work cultures that are fear-based, right? We're always afraid of making mistakes, or we're afraid of saying the wrong thing around the wrong person. Some of us have family lives that also have cultures of fear. Our marriage dynamics may be fear-based. Some of us, we're afraid of what's around us, but also we're afraid of what we're missing out on, right? So maybe you've heard of this term, FOMO. I work with college students, so I've learned this, FOMO. Sometimes you'll see hashtag FOMO, it stands for the fear of missing out. Pastor Dale, have you heard this before? Have you? Okay, good. I was seeing how hip you are. You're hip, you pass. For those who are not as hip, FOMO is this idea that you can't truly appreciate what you have because you're always fearful of what you're missing out on. All right, so if you go out with one group of friends and then you see on social media that another group of friends is having fun, you just can't even appreciate your current friends because you're afraid of missing out on what they're doing, right? And it's usually associated with like college students and high school students. But adults have FOMO. There's a lot of FOMO with adults, right? There's a lot of people our age that look at other people and say, oh man, he's got a good life. Maybe I should have been a lawyer or I should have been an engineer. Some of us may look at other families and they say, oh, they seem so happy. Maybe I should have married that guy and not this guy, you know. Maybe we have FOMO about coming to China and we look back and say, maybe I should have stayed in my home country or gone to, you know, some other country. But the problem is fear begets fear. Fear just leads to more and more fear in our lives. It's debilitating, it's contagious. And God does not call us to fear. He does not call us to live a life of fear. I mean, if you read throughout the Bible, there's one of the most common commands in the Bible is do not fear. Do not be afraid. Fear not, right? This is in Genesis, God tells Isaac, do not be afraid, for I am with you. And when he appoints Joshua to lead the Israelites, he says, be strong and courageous and do not be afraid. And when the angels visit Zechariah and Mary in the book of Luke, they come and the first thing they say to them is, do not be afraid. And Jesus himself, after he's resurrected from the dead, right? After he rises from the dead and he looks for his disciples, the first thing that he says to his disciples is, do not fear. Do not be afraid. We are called not to live our lives in fear. And this passage in Revelation actually starts with, and it actually starts in chapter 1, it starts by saying, do not be afraid. That's the first line of this whole passage to the seven churches. And then it's repeated again to the church in Smyrna specifically. Now, mind you, Smyrna, they were not afraid of things that were hypothetical. Right? They weren't afraid of the what ifs. They were actually being persecuted. And among their community were people who were actually being imprisoned, right? Their lives were actually in danger, but even still, Jesus says to them, do not be afraid. Some of you will suffer. Some of you will go to prison and be persecuted. Be faithful even unto death. Do not be afraid. So how do we do this? How do we simply not fear? Especially when we feel afraid, how do we just not fear? And I think the solution is not simply mustering up the willpower to be courageous, right? Fear needs to be replaced by something that can overcome it, something that's more powerful. And it says what that is in the Bible. It says there's something that can drive out fear from our lives. It's in 1 John chapter 4. It's a great exposition on love, and it leads to this verse, verse 18. It says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear. Perfect love drives out fear. Perfect love. And where can we find this perfect love? The world cannot offer this kind of love. Our spouses and our children, as much as we love them, they cannot give us that perfect kind of love. The affirmations of our friends and our bosses, they cannot give us that kind of love. Only God through Jesus Christ can give us that kind of love, the perfect love that drives out fear. So the invitation of Christ is an invitation to move out of fear and into his perfect love. So this year has also been kind of a challenging year for me. Back in September, I kind of threw my hat in the ring for a job that I actually really wanted. It would have brought me back to the U.S., and it made a lot of sense, and ultimately I didn't get it. I should start by saying I didn't get it, but it was a long process. It was more than 6 months, and In that time, it ultimately came down to myself and one other person. And in that time, I invested a lot emotionally. Sometimes if you've gone through this process, like mentally, I was there. I was like, oh, this is happening, and I'm excited about this, and we're getting logistically ready for that. And then as we came down to the end, and as the last probably, it seemed like 10 years, but the last like 5 or 6 weeks when they were making their decision, the anxiety started coming in. The fear started coming in. And I started, oh gosh, what if I don't get this? And what if, then what? Like, what am I going to do now? Like, all of a sudden, all of that I had plans for made so much sense. And if those get taken away, what can I do now? What should I do? And there was so much fear and anxiety in my life that I was missing sleep. I was waking up in the middle of the night, and I'd be awake at 3 a.m. and not be able to fall back asleep. I was feeling fear throughout work, throughout the day. And so during that time, God called me to respond in two ways, okay? The first way is just to meditate on him more. Meditate on his perfect love. So, it almost sounds simple, but I prayed more. I read my Bible more. I actually memorized scripture with it, which is very powerful. And in particular, God called me to memorize the whole of Psalm 23, the whole of the psalm. And every time that I felt the anxieties, the whispers of anxiety start coming into my mind, I would recite it. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul, and on and on. And as I would say that, I would say it in taxi cabs. I would say it when I'd wake up in the middle of the night. I would say it at work. As I would say that, it would replace the fear in my mind with God's love, with God's perfect love. It would drive out fear. So that was the first thing. Meditate more on his love. The second thing that he called me to do, and it may sound counterintuitive, but he called me to enter into my fears and confront the brokenness and the anxieties inside me. One of the truly miraculous truths of the gospel is that God loves us, right? He loves me. He loves you. He loves us as humanity. He loves us as individuals. And we can enter into that love. And in that presence, in the presence of his perfect love, we can enter into our brokenness. We can go into the betrayals and the disappointments and the frustrations and the physical pains and the emotional pains and the fear. And we can enter into those areas of brokenness with the knowledge that God is with us. And God is there. And it's only in those deepest places of darkness and brokenness can we truly know the depths of God's comfort and his mercy and his grace and his love. And not only that, another amazing thing is God can actually use our brokenness, right? He can use our brokenness to bring about a greater glory. You know, being a Christ follower does not mean that we are shielded from the challenges of our lives. Rather, we are strengthened to confront them. And through them, God can do amazing things. We can look no farther than the life of Jesus himself to see how God uses brokenness to bring about a greater glory. Right? Jesus, who is the Son of God, he came down to experience the afflictions of this world. And he suffered the scorn and the shame of men. He was ridiculed. He was betrayed. And ultimately, he was beaten and hung on a cross to die for a crime that he did not commit. But God used the brokenness of Jesus to bring about a much greater glory. Because it's only through Christ's sacrifice on the cross that death no longer has its sting. And we can be reconciled with God for eternity. In the same way, God is calling many of you here today to enter into your brokenness. Be shielded, be covered in the perfect love of God. Go into the brokenness. Do not be afraid. Go there knowing that God has a plan. God has a plan for your life, and we should not fear. Like the church in Smyrna, many of us are afflicted and or afraid in our own ways. And God tells us, do not be afraid. In your afflictions, you are rich. Let's pray.